A few years back, Chris Kimball set out to recreate a moment in culinary history. He's the host of America's Test Kitchen on PBS, and he decided to prepare an elaborate 12-course dinner using cooking methods and a famous cookbook from the Victorian era.
On one hand, Victorian culture was extremely rigid. On the other hand, when you got to the kitchen, they went wild. So I think the food, in a way, in Victorian times, was the mode of expression.
The year was 1896 when Boston's Fanny Farmer published the best-selling cookbook of the era. And Boston is where Chris Kimball put on one spectacular dinner party. I was one of the lucky guests. We wore satin and jewels, ate from gold-edged antique china, sipped champagne beneath a mermaid carved from ice, and were served a menu that took hours to eat.
Oysters, mock turtle soup, rissole, which are stuffed puff pastries, lobster l'Americaine, saddle of venison with potatoes and beets, wood-grilled salmon, fried baby artichokes, canton, which is ginger frozen punch, roast goose with chestnut stuffing and applesauce, three Victorian jellies, a mandarin cake, a two-layer cake, and finally, coffee cheese crackers and candies.
Out of this dinner served last autumn came Chris's newest book called Fanny's Last Supper.
Here's an interesting thing about this dinner. You put restrictions on yourself in the sense that you were going to use as much of the old technology as humanly possible.
Almost everything was cooked on a 67-inch coal cook stove built in the 1880s. We converted it to wood. We didn't use modern ovens at all. We might have used a mixer for a couple things, but everything else was just knives, basic implements, and the coal cook stove.
Who back in 1896 would have actually attempted this meal?
Well, if you were middle class or upper middle class or wealthy, a 12-course meal around Thanksgiving or Christmas or special occasion was not unusual. In fact, what happened towards the end of the 1800s is people got very interested in etiquette and how you gave a dinner. So by getting these books and having these dinners, people felt like they were, you know, aspiring to being higher socially. So there were rules, and the rules were never discuss politics at dinner. You'd upset the digestion of guests, something that's not true today. You would never leave tooth marks on your foods. You never bite into an apple or a peach because you could see the tooth marks. You would leave food on the plate. You shouldn't be hungry. You should be above hunger.
There is a short passage in the book describing what your day in your kitchen was like during the 2 years you worked on this project. If you wouldn't mind reading it for us, just a paragraph. It's page 72 here. Let me give you my book.
So over a two-year period, we spent days and weeks at the stove, getting to know each other's culinary skills and personality quirks. The routine never changed. The day started with cranking up the massive cast iron cook stove before dawn, a waffle breakfast, a review of the schedule, much like a football coach prepping his team for the big game, and then a headlong rush into a full day of boiling calves' heads, poaching brains, roasting venison, or baking cakes.
This was quite a challenge. It's one thing to serve a 12-course meal. It's another thing, obviously, to serve a 12-course meal from recipes that are more than 100 years old. And what were the main things you found when you tackled these old recipes?
Well, the first thing is, in the old days, recipes weren't like they are now. They're very short. So there was a lot of things you needed to know that were left unsaid. For example, mock turtle soup was not made with turtle because it was expensive. They boiled a calf's head, and that gave a similar flavor. What they didn't tell us the first time we did it was, take out the brains. So I boiled a calf's head with a brain in it, and I got a really thick, gloppy stock. It was awful. So I finally dug up a recipe from a New York author back in the 1880s. It said, you know, step one, take brains out. We didn't know that.
One of the most amazing dishes was the venison, but until I read this book, I did not realize you practically burned the house down.
We actually did. In fact, we had the day before we were working on it, the fire department actually did come because we set off the alarms.
This was a kitchen so hot it was hard to be in.
By the air conditioner, it was 93 degrees. By the oven, it was 120 to 130. You could not stand by the stove and work. You'd have to crouch down and get your body as far as possible with the longest spoon you could possibly find. You could not stand at the stove for more than 5 or 6 seconds. Erin McMurray, my test kitchen director, her pants actually started to melt. We actually, in one case, wrapped aluminum foil around her pants, actually, to keep the heat off of them.
Chris, as you always do, you've brought in some of these delicious dishes, and today it's the jellies. These are molded jellies, very elegant. Describe for us what we're looking at here.
These jellies, there are three of them. There's a basic lemon jelly with four different layers. And by the way, they used to make their own food coloring, spinach for green, cream for white, saffron for yellow, and beets for red, which we did. These are made by boiling calves' feet. I know you're looking, Renee's looking at me like I'm crazy. And you split them in half, and you simmer them for hours, and then you mix in sugar and lemon juice, and that becomes, and it sets up in the refrigerator when it's chilled, just like a pure, clear gelatin.
Would these molds be just as good made with powdered gelatin, the way we buy it today?
And it would be slightly easier. Yes, you can.
A lot easier.
In the book, we provide the powdered gelatin version of it. You don't actually have to use calf's feet. But we just wanted to see if you could do it. And very few people know. This is one of the great things American cooks did, was produce these incredibly complex molds. In fact, a lot of families had their own molds made for them, copper molds or steel molds made. So it was quite an important part of the dining table.
This undertaking of yours, Chris, would you do it again?
I don't know if I'd do this dinner again, but look, I mean, you can't look at old recipes and cookbooks and really get the past. You have to cook it. That process of cooking the food for a year and a half, I learned more about 1890s and the Victorians and Fanny Farmer than if I had read 1,000 books on it. So, sure. And besides which, pulling off the dinner party, it was a blast. I mean, it was, it was like opening night on Broadway. So, yeah, I would do it again.
That was Chris Kimball, whose new book is Fanny's Last Supper, Recreating One Amazing Meal from Fanny Farmer's 1896 Cookbook. And you can see Chris Kimball's exquisite Victorian dinner at our website, npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. A nationwide ring has been charged with trying to steal more than $160 million from Medicare. Elsa Chang from member station WNYC reports.
Prosecutors are calling it the largest Medicare fraud scheme ever committed by a single group. 73 people operating across 25 states have been charged in a scheme allegedly run by an Armenian-American organized crime group. The U.S. attorney in Manhattan, Preet Bharara, says the suspects stole identities from thousands of doctors and legitimate Medicare patients. They set up phony health clinics and billed Medicare for treatments that were never performed.
Today's indictments should send a strong message to those who think that they can game our country's healthcare system and steal taxpayer dollars that have been earmarked for our nation's elderly.
Here's how it allegedly worked. Many of the bogus clinics were simply mailbox addresses. From there, members of the ring would send Medicare bills for expensive treatments. Prosecutors say the criminals often got sloppy. Eye doctors billed for bladder treatments. Dermatologists billed for heart exams. The group supposedly took advantage of the user-friendly side of Medicare. It tries to pay healthcare providers promptly by not verifying whether treatments have actually been rendered before it sends money. Among those in custody is Armin Kazarian. The FBI calls him the VOR, or godfather, of the operation. And investigators say he's the first VOR ever arrested for racketeering in the U.S. For NPR News, I'm Elsa Chang in New York.
Tomorrow, Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, will outline his latest plan to resuscitate the U.S. economy. For some details, we turn now to our favorite Fed watcher, David Wessel, the economics editor of the Wall Street Journal. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Renee.
Now, the Fed has held short-term interest rates near zero for almost 2 years, but Ben Bernanke insists that the Fed can do more. But you want to know what more is there for it to do?
Well, that's right, Renee. Ben Bernanke is thinking about something that they call quantitative easing. As you point out, he cut short-term interest rates, the overnight rates that banks pay, down to zero. And then they went beyond that and they bought $1.7 trillion worth of bonds and mortgages to push down the long-term interest rates set in bond markets, the ones that determine mortgage rates and corporate borrowing rates. That was an extraordinary effort. They suspended it in March because they thought kind of job done. But now, with inflation running lower than the Fed's target and unemployment much higher than the Fed's target and no prospect of it coming down rapidly, the Fed is basically signaling they're going to resume this bond buying, a decision they'll probably make at their meeting in early November.
And now how does that work? Are you talking about quantitative easing?
Well, basically what they do is they buy a lot of bonds. When you buy a lot of bonds, the price goes up and the yield or the interest rate on them goes down. That makes it interest rates lower, and the Fed hopes that people will borrow more, but they know that in today's climate that's unlikely. So part of the game is to kind of chase investors out of treasuries, because the Fed will be buying those, and instead push them into riskier securities like the stock market, so the stock market will go up.
And am I hearing you right? The Fed is trying to make the stock market go up?
Well, that's not exactly how Mr. Bernanke will put it in his speech on Friday. But yes, the Fed is hoping that by boosting the price of stocks and other assets, that'll make everybody feel a little bit richer and everybody will spend a little more readily and the economy will grow just a little bit faster and we'll get to the point of full employment sooner.
But wasn't it low interest rates and excessive borrowing that created the housing bubble, which, you know, many of us would say got us in the mess we're in, or at least was a big part of it? Why would the Fed try those policies again?
Well, that is a risk. And that's why some officials at the Fed are kind of or distinctly enthusiastic about doing this. But Mr. Bernanke's calculus is pretty straightforward. Yes, there are risks to spending another $500 billion on buying bonds and trying to get people to borrow and lend and having all this money sloshing around the system. But I think that in his judgment, to do nothing is worse. To do nothing is to tolerate slow growth and high unemployment and fears that we're slipping into deflation. And so he just basically isn't willing to stand by and say, I could do something, but I'm afraid to do it. He's trying to prevent the U.S. from repeating the experience of Japan by having a decade of stagnation and low growth and deflation fears.
Okay, if the Fed is talking about doing more to stimulate the economy, it looks like it could really do that. Would that influence Congress? That is, make it look towards stimulating the economy as well? I mean, at the moment, that's bad politics, I think, but would that change?
Maybe. I don't know. Predicting the Fed is relatively easy these days. Predicting what Congress is going to do is almost impossible. In this instance, I think the Fed actually would prefer that Congress did something. They'd prefer that Congress did some short-term stimulus and package it with a believable deficit reduction plan. But they don't think that's going to happen. And so they're not prepared to let the economy languish while the politicians bicker and have partisan stuff and the economy just doesn't go anywhere. So they're kind of stepping into the vacuum. Ironically, that's what happened at the beginning of the financial crisis. When Congress and the president couldn't fight back, the Fed did. And we seem to be right back at that point again.
David, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
David Wessel is economics editor of The Wall Street Journal and a frequent guest on our program.